Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yu Yunzhen, host of our monthly China podcast, Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about Chinese economy. Today, we are diving deep into the EU's anti-subsidy investigation into Chinese electric vehicles. As usual, I am with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi, Alicia, how are you?
Very fine, thank you, Yu Yun.
Also joining us from Bath today is George Magnus, a research associate at the China Center of Oxford University. George, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Thank you, Yu.
So let's dive in. In October 2023, the European Union launched an investigation into whether Chinese electric vehicle manufacturers were receiving unfair subsidies that gave them an advantage in the market. The investigation aimed to determine if these subsidies violated international trade rules and possibly led to market distortions. In June 2024, the European Commission announced the preliminary conclusion that it would levy additional tariffs of between 17.4% and 38% on Chinese electric vehicles, on top of an existing 10% import duty. Alicia, could you give us a quick take on this investigation?
Well, this is, as you rightly point out, just an investigation, and it has not been finalized. So the first thing I need to say is that these are countervailing duties. These are not import tariffs, you know, that will remain. It will depend on two things, whether they remain or not. First is Europe itself. So basically the European Council. The European Council could, in November, although, you know, it could be earlier, decide otherwise if it reaches qualified majority against the decision taken by the Commission. So that's the first hurdle. The second one is the WTO itself. So, you know, China could, which I read China was intending to do, but I don't know whether it has actually done it. Maybe George knows. Basically file a case against the result of the investigation when it comes out. So there's a lot of things that might happen. But I think the key here is that the Commission has signaled a change in direction in terms of its approach to China's, I would say, China's economic model. I wouldn't even say subsidies only, because we all know that the investigation itself has gone beyond subsidies. So I would say that it does signal a change of direction. Whether that direction will come back to where it was because of pressure, we'll discuss that later. Yeah.
George, do you want to add to that?
Not a whole lot at this juncture, other than obviously to note that, you know, the European Commission has gone about this in a very different way from the US administration. The situations arguably are quite different. And yeah, there are still sort of dates on the in the diary, so to speak, at which there could be some pulling back from this. I mean, I think in July, I think the Commission is going to say something or confirm its investigations. And I think member states vote, as Alicia said, in October or November. So, yeah, there are opportunities, really, which I think the Chinese government is probably trying to take advantage of to try to sway the decision to scrap them or not to implement them in the first place. So we'll have to wait and see how all of this kind of evolves. But, yeah, I mean, certainly there is a change of direction afoot, which I think is probably more important in a way than the specific measures which were posed.
What has prompted this change to China?
I think there's a sort of a growing frustration, I think, not just in Europe, but of course in the United States, that goes without saying, but also in several other countries as well, both developed market economies and some emerging economies as well. I mean, a growing frustration with the consequences of, you know, what is perceived to be an industrial policy in China, which has, I mean, industrial policy and trade policy are sort of two sides of the same coin. But the idea that, you know, markets are going to remain open to whatever it is that China is choosing to export, and where prices may be just super, super competitive to the point where they are, distortions. I think people, I think countries or nation states really look to me increasingly as though they're pushing back against this. And I think we should see the European action here in that context.
Alicia, would you agree with that?
Fully. And, George and I have been discussing this both in at Bruegel and then in Paris. So it seems hard to disagree by now, because I think George's arguments on both industrial policy, but also how innovation is supported by industrial policy and what it all means, are really important in a way to understand why the Commission has changed tune. And it is because if you remember what happened in 2019, and George surely knows that our changing from from full engagement to this I would call it impossible trinity, because it's you have all of these things together: cooperation, and then competition, and then rivalry. So I think what is happening here is that the rivalry aspect is coming out, perhaps not necessarily for the same reasons as the US, which is great power competition, hegemony. But I think in the case of Europe, the rivalry comes from the fact that the competition, the second part, which in principle should be healthy. Yeah, competition should be healthy. We all like competition, but it's less and less healthy because it's distorted. And this is where the massive industrial policy comes to the forefront. China's, I would say, induced, maybe not forced, localization, foreign companies localizing China, contributing, again, forcefully or not, to China's innovation ecosystem through tech transfer. All of that is converting this word competition into something more like rivalry. And I think that has been the turning point for the Commission.
Do you think it is appropriate for the Commission to intervene with trade policy?
Well, the Commission has been, what I would say, Union is quite shy, because everything they've done is WTO compliant, or so we hope. So this is something that the WTO offers its members to go for. Yeah, this is not the first anti-subsidy investigation. It won't be the last, because China is also actually announcing it will do several, including either anti-dumping or anti-subsidy investigations. On as we have heard recently on pork, and I'm sure there will be many more. So Europe is basically just using the instruments available at the WTO for the moment. The question is, will it go further?
George, do you think it will go further?
I think it probably will, and I think it's a very, very sensitive policy area, because certainly from a economic point of view, I mean, we're kind of trained almost in Pavlovian fashion to reject the idea about interventionism in trade policy, like, for example, imposition of tariffs and promotion of subsidies and all of this kind of stuff. I mean, it happens. Generally speaking, the whole of the post-war period has been about trying to limit the degree to which it does happen, and to provide mechanisms so that where there is believed to be unfairness, that countries have a right of appeal, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things are becoming much more complicated, particularly given what's going on or not going on in the WTO. And it's really tricky, because on the one hand, intervention into trade, can have some positive effects. I mean, from one point of view, it can have some positive effects. It can, for example, if you tariff products in a kind of a protective way, it can have national security implications that you want to meet. It can protect industries and the retention of skills and workforce and knowledge, public goods. It can change, the way that the economy is kind of structured. These are all kinds of things that might follow from the imposition of kind of interventions in trade. On the other hand, of course, it has a long history of being associated with things that don't really aren't particularly welcome or pleasing. Like, firms can capture governments, and governments can capture firms. The promotion of national champions isn't something that we generally feel is a good thing or has worked out well. There might be kind of rampant corruption, the risk of retaliation, as we saw in the 1930s. I mean, all of these things make this kind of intervention by the commission. I mean, I don't mean this specific intervention with electric vehicles, but the principle of intervention is obviously very sensitive for all of these reasons. But I would say the world economy and the world environment has clearly changed dramatically from that which you know, existed when the IMF and the World Bank and the World Trade Organization and so on and so forth were all kind of created and the rules were built. So I think we are in this kind of grey area, really, where we are looking to see if changes are needed, but it's very difficult to know what kind of changes will work. And but that most people are agreed that some sort of change is required. Yeah.
I think, you know, we are totally on the same page here on the fact that, yes, we're starting with these investigations, but, you know, this is a change in direction, clearly, not because of the investigation, but because this is one of the very many investigations. Yeah. I mean, we have wind turbines, we have legacy chips. Some are through our international procurement, basically the changes in international procurement. We also have anti-foreign subsidy legislation, which is a European legislation. So there's many. This is just Europe realizing that all of these protective measures that Europe piled up in the event of, I mean, basically realizing that the world was changing, need to be used. And that's where we are now. So I would say that maybe we don't need to focus too much on this particular case, but as George said, this is a change, clear change in direction. So we'll see many more things coming.
Like you said, with the proposal that the commission has come up with, it's actually on the reasonable side, meaning that it didn't propose like massive tariffs. Maybe could you just elaborate a bit on that?
We have from 18 to 30, I think 38 or something like that. But the point is, this depends on whether you've collaborated or not in terms of providing data. And let's be honest, I don't think we know what the amount of subsidies are. I mean, I don't think anybody knows. So these are just rough estimates. And the difference is how much you've collaborated with the investigation. You have not collaborated, then it's the max. But that max is actually not very high. If you think about Turkey with 40% tariffs, US 100, I'm sure those tariffs are not calculated, so they are not a benchmark. But the reality is that Europe remains, out of all of those countries imposing tariffs, the least ad hoc, if I may say, because it's trying to differentiate among EV makers and their collaboration, but also hopefully the amount of support they've received. But I say so hopefully because I'm not sure we know.
It's probably also fair to say, isn't it, Alicia, that, you know, I mean, the member states are not necessarily aligned behind this policy. Some countries, notably Germany, of course, are not really very much in favor. So, I mean, the EU has gone, or the Commission has gone about this in a much more kind of delicate way, and just kind of given notice of its displeasure, but also in a way that is consistent with its policy of, quote, de-risking, unquote, right?
Yeah. George, you hit the nail here, and it's a big nail because it's the biggest country in Europe that is not happy with the Commission's decision. And, you know, the worst is, George, is that I don't know why Germany isn't happy, because Germany has actually more to lose than anybody else if these tariffs aren't imposed. So basically, this is a country captured by its own largest automakers, in essence, to be very frank. But it's not a country captured by its own interests, which is very different. And I think that's the irony of this case. If you think about Germany's future, Germany is the industrial power of Europe. I mean, who's going to lose the most by China continue to move up the ladder with or without subsidies and, you know, basically competing with exactly Germany in third markets and by now in its own in the single market and in its own country. So, you know, I just don't understand Germany's displeasure. I like that word. Why would you be displeased by this measure? I don't get it. And that says a lot about how fragile the whole thing is, because it's really about a few companies, very few, if you think about it in number, it's more about relevance, that are really pushing very hard for this decision not to be taken.
So as you said, the member states still have to discuss and then come back with a decision on this. How do you think this is likely to play out, given that you already discussed that Germany is very harsh against this?
Frankly, it would be terrible for the incoming commission, because this is going to be the incoming commission, to start this way, yeah? Basically with something that requires qualified majority, because that's what it's needed to turn the commission's decision to impose countervailing duties, to basically go down the drain. So the reason why I think it might actually go through is that it would be implosive for the new commission to see that happening, yeah? And also because, frankly, we not only need Germany, we need qualified majorities. So, you know, you need quite a few countries showing up. I'm sure some will be there. Hungary will be there. Maybe Slovakia will be there. Some for even economic interests, yeah? So, long story short, I think it could be feasible, but it would be a disaster for the new commission. So it might not happen for that reason.
I mean, just to add a small observation, I mean, I think there are lots of moving parts here, which Alicia, which you just kind of outlined. But also, you know, on the China side, for example, there are some things on the calendar already. Like, for example, we know that, you know, next month there's going to be the third plenum. And so we're expecting to see a big focus on China's industrial and related kind of policies, which may kind of change the way or influence the way that people think about this. And also, one of the things which is not on the calendar, but it's just a phenomenon that's been going on during the course of the last 12 to 18 months, is China's share of world exports has been rising pretty quickly. And a lot of that has to do with electric vehicles and batteries and solar and wind and other climate change mitigation equipment and so on. So if these trends obviously if they continue to be as robust as they seem to have been during the last 12 to 18 months, one might imagine that the kind of lobbying is not only going to be by German automobile manufacturers, but also by others who, and you know, who knows, new French government, we know no idea what that might look like, but others to basically try to draw a line here. So yeah, just what I just wanted to say, that, you know, many things can change between here and the autumn.
Maybe let's zoom into China's industrial policy for a second, because this has been the result of that. We have seen this argument saying that there's an overcapacity problem in China. That's why it's trying to dump its products into the world market, although there's not much need of it compared to the past. Would you agree with this?
Yeah, I do agree with it, up to a point. But I think it's also, the context is important. The issue with, with China's emphasis just at this particular time on exports of EVs, electric vehicles, batteries, and climate change mitigation equipment. This isn't the lion's share of Chinese exports. It's actually, you know, probably less than, I don't know, 7 or 8% of Chinese exports, but obviously making waves, particularly with electric vehicles, but actually not only with electric vehicles, but with internal combustion engine vehicles as well, where the overcapacity, if anything, is even a bigger problem than it is with EVs. And so what I think we ought to be kind of looking at really is a kind of the policy environment in China, in which there's this kind of obsession with what the Chinese call supply side reform or supply side policies, which are really about cranking up the production side of the economy, but not doing enough, I would say, on the demand side of the economy. So, I mean, if you look at it in terms of a sort of global picture, China is about 18% of global GDP. It's about a third of global manufacturing and about 13% of global consumption. So there's this imbalance really in China between production and consumption is really what results in the overcapacity of individual products. Now, there may be arguments about whether, you know, electric vehicles, for example, are a classic case of overcapacity, but there are certainly lots of other things in steel, shipbuilding, industrial materials like glass and cement, railway and highway infrastructure, property, internal combustion engines. There are lots of things where there is a chronic mismatch within the Chinese economy between supply and demand. And the result of that, in traded goods at least, is that a lot of them get exported. And we've seen this kind of significant rise in anti-dumping or other kind of complaints about unfair trade practices. So it's definitely a structural problem. It's not just a kind of a temporary or a cyclical issue. Yeah, it's all kind of wrapped up. I mean, the Chinese defense to all of this is the rest of the world, particularly the Americans and the Europeans, are just jealous about China's comparative advantage. But in a world of comparative advantage, exports are not only, you know, your exports aren't only quite strong, your imports are quite strong too. But China's imports are not, because the demand side of the economy is not really getting the same attention as the supply side.
But what has changed compared to the past? Because China has always been called the world factory. So by default, it's producing money in order to export to the world. Is it because now the external market are not as receptive? They don't need it as much? Why do you think Chinese products are no longer popular?
I mean, in large parts of the world, I think obviously they still are. I think the problem is, A, that since just before COVID, and certainly since COVID itself, there's been a particular kind of weakness in Chinese consumption. I mean, it was there before, but it's become more marked. And then, of course, you know, it's sort of complicated by the fact that the optics of China's huge emphasis, or doubling down really, on industrial policy and manufacturing has come at a really poor time from a national security and from kind of, you know, communications and technology point of view. So it's just a lot of bad things coming together, I think.
Yeah. Also, Alicia, I remember in the previous conversation we had, for now, China's economy, the case is that security trumps economics. So perhaps that's also a reason that...
Yes, totally. So maybe I would like to add to why, because your question is well taken. In fact, we get this many times, you know, also in Chinese media, that why are you upset now? Because now we can do what you used to do and you don't like it and blah. I understand that reaction. You know, it sounds like, wow, now the West is upset and they are putting barriers. But I think we also need to realize the following. When China was, and still is even more so, a factory of the world, China was a poor country. And so why did it become a factory of the world? Because it had a lot of savings, which excess savings, so it could finance all of this manufacturing, you know, without a huge current account deficits. They could import all of these intermediate goods, assemble them and re-export them, and no questions asked, and everything was fine. But at that time, China's income per capita was lower than that of India today. So, you know, the point is, why not? This is providing cheaper goods to the world. At some point, China will consume more and this imbalance will disappear. But it has not disappeared. It's actually gotten worse. That's the irony. Excess savings are higher in China. Actually, the household savings are higher. People aren't consuming. The consumption to GDP is the same. If anything, there is substitution of imports, as we know very well. The import share is plummeting, especially from the West, for that matter, because commodities are still coming into China, but certainly not intermediate goods, manufacturing, machinery from Germany. All of that is gone. So, you know, I hope that if somebody hears me from that end, from China,
they can understand that it's not the same. China's income per capita is $13,000 per capita, for God's sake. And I think, frankly, this is not by chance. This is not by chance. This is a model. The model is, I keep on doing this until I've moved fully up the ladder and I keep my consumption, you know, low because I want to keep on having this trade surplus, which, by the way, China desperately needs. And I finish here because of the financial account outflows. People may be doing this and they have these high savings, but if you allow them, they will put a lot of that money out of China, as we are seeing with a very weak RMB. So, you know, it looks strong, but it isn't as strong. And I think that's why China holds onto it, because it doesn't have many other options. So I guess the West is saying, where are your options? Why don't you consume? So that's where the clash comes about much more than electric vehicles. That's the biggest message I want to offer to our audience. This is not about electric vehicles. If anything, George reminds us, that's where we even know less whether there's overcapacity, because this is something that is growing, that, you know, we don't even know how many electric vehicles the world will need. So I wouldn't even talk about overcapacity. It's a clash of models. They just don't go together. And this is, finally, we're seeing this. We're seeing this clash of economic models right there. George wrote a book explaining why those models were different. We're right there. Now we know for a fact, everybody knows, that these two models put together don't lead to stability, you know, of the model. It just doesn't add up. And that's it. That's where we are.
I think Alicia described it really well. Unfortunately, I think it is a structural phenomenon, which has led to this kind of situation where there is this kind of clash between the way that we think, I say we in the West, you know, think that a global economic system should function. And obviously, you know, China has different kind of views about this. I mean, all I would say is, I mean, it was as a sort of an apropos, in 2023 was the 300th anniversary of the birth of Adam Smith, who, you know, was nothing if not renowned to be a kind of a fanatic about free trade and, you know, libertarian economics and so on and so forth. But he was absolutely adamant in his writing and in his opinion that countries that made a kind of a virtue of earning export surpluses, in other words, exploiting comparative advantage only on one side of the equation, but not importing on the other, were you know, definitely not his favorite countries. And he thought that it was justified to take measures to oppose countries that performed in this way. Well, subsequently, you know, we've kind of learned that to label this kind of behavior as mercantilism. And to be fair, China's not the only country that pursues it. I mean, you could look at countries that have, you know, entrenched balance of payments surpluses like Japan or South Korea, even Germany, for example. You could kind of raise the same sort of objections to their own domestic models as well. But obviously, China's scale is a kind of a multiple of pretty much everybody else put together. So that's why we care about it. You know, it has a manufacturing trade surplus that's probably underreported at about 8% of GDP. And is you know, the whole kind of industrial strategy now is to try to boost that and enhance it. So I just think the pushback that China is likely to face. And that's why, you know, at the beginning of our session here today, we talked about whether the commission's decision was a sort of a one-off or a kind of a down payment. I suspect it's a down payment because many countries are saying, you know, basta, is enough, and we have to kind of draw a line and try and change things. And it creates a lot of tension, unfortunately.
Thank you very much. For listeners who are interested, I will put a link of George's book in the show notes so you can access through there. And also there's Alicia's recent paper on industrial policy where she examines how China's industrial policy has played out and what implications we have for Europe. So before I close this session, perhaps I could just ask you to get a quick conclusion note for today, maybe starting with you, Alicia. What implications do you see that China's overcapacity will bring to the world, and how the EU and how the world should react to it?
Frankly, I think those who should worry the most are countries with growing population, decent size, and trying to develop even more than us. Brazil, India, Turkey, you know. Because what kind of industrial policy can they do to protect themselves? So this doesn't end with us. This ends with everybody else. The larger you are, the more people you need to employ, the worse. This is why I think this eventually could put into question China's role in the global south. I think that's the next step, especially if Europe closes down, which is a big question mark. Because if the US does, then Europe does, then all of these exports will go to the global south. And their trade balances are already quite unbalanced, and there will be even more. And then the question is, will there be emerging trade wars in emerging countries? There are already some. But will there be currency wars? So, you know, we're getting into a different level, basically, because the US, yes, we know, but what about the rest?
Thank you, Alicia. George?
Well, I do agree with that. And it's slightly depressing thought, you know, to kind of reflect on the fact that trade conflict and commercial conflict, actually, it's less optimal, and it produces costs and distortions and political ruptions, which, you know, we're not really accustomed to during the last, well, up until, you know, a few years ago, the world looked quite different. But if I could just kind of finish on a slightly more cheerful note, maybe. I mean, that although I think there's a lot of things to regret and to lose if we kind of go down this path. I mean, there are going to be some winners too. And you know, one of the things that we can see in this kind of period of fragmentation of trade and investment, of which, of course, the kind of whole kind of tariff and subsidy debate is part of this. Is some extraordinary things which have been going on in Mexico and countries like Vietnam and India and Thailand, which have benefited enormously from trade diversion and from investment diversion. So, I mean, from a policy point of view, I quite agree with everything Alicia has said. There's nothing really much to, you know, to be cheerful about, because it's a much less efficient and optimal and prosperous path than we otherwise might have been on. But, you know, politics is what it is. But also from a business point of view and from an investment point of view, I think, you know, there are going to be winners as well as losers. And so just to balance out the argument a little bit.
Thank you very much, George, for providing a cheerful note at the end. Thank you very much for joining me for this discussion. My name is Yuyun Zhan. I am with Alicia Garcia Herrero, Senior Fellow here at Bruegel, and also George Magnus, Research Associate at the China Center of Oxford University. For listeners, you can find all our research on China at Bruegel.org and sign up for our China podcast and newsletter with link in the show notes. Until next time, bye-bye.